Is it education or manipulation? The time is way overdue to rethink ethnic studies in America. A man with a plan and a student with a perspective talk about where we are and where we need to go. Let's bust some pencils.
This is Busted Pencils Radio, fully leaded education talk with Dr. Tim Slecker. Here's what's trending in education news.
From NBCNews.com, Mike Pence calls criticism of wife's job at anti-LGBTQ school deeply offensive. Karen Pence is teaching art part-time at a Virginia school that explicitly bars lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender employees and students.
Yeah, so there, take that.
So that's where she's working.
That's where she's working. And Mike Pence finds it deeply offensive that somebody like me is offended that the vice president's wife is teaching in a school that explicitly says that if you're gay or any type of
immoral behavior
stated by that old book called the Bible.
You know that one.
Right? Yep. I am offended by her teaching this, but if you read the article, he twists this into saying that this is a criticism of, quote, religious education. And that's offensive to him because American education has always had a deeply Christian education bend to it.
But Tim, this was an article attacking her, not attacking education.
Right. And although I'll throw in there, I've got no problem criticizing and attacking, quote, Christian religious education because it's not public, it's private. And that also is part of the deal. Now, somebody would say, I can pay for an anti-gay biased kind of education if I want. If I want to pay to learn to hate people, that's my right.
And there's schools out there for
there
that,
are schools out
yes.
there. But if you're the vice president's wife, do you openly take a job working in a school that knowingly, in fact, has a morality clause that if you engage in any of this type of anti-biblical behavior, you can be let go, removed, and all of these things? I mean, is this what the vice president's wife should be doing?
But my question is, how did he not expect the criticism?
Because he's a white Christian guy who expects no criticism to ever come upon him.
Okay, that makes sense.
It's arrogant to me to see that, first of all, again, trying to twist this into a critique of quote, religious education.
Right.
And there are some religious institutions out there that do a darn good job educating people. In fact, if you look very closely at the number of statistics of religious people, well over 70% of religious people across religions are offended by this hardcore
right.
biblical stance to education. So it's not a critique on religious education. It's a critique on a very biased, anti-gay, anti-LGBT, anti-our own neighbors curriculum.
From WPTV.com, Florida leaders to discuss changes to Florida teacher licensing exam amid high failure rates. Florida teachers struggling to pass the Florida's teacher certification exam may have more fuel to question its fairness.
Oh, so it's not a fair test of teachers, is what we're possibly saying
here. That's what it looks
okay.
like, right?
Yeah, in fact, that's what the article is about. I worry about the headline of this article that sounds like, oh, there go teachers looking for an easy way out.
Right.
And they don't
yeah.
want to pass their test to become a teacher. And, you know, lawyers take tests and engineers take tests. And
So teachers should take a test too.
Maybe not. But if you have a crappy test, and that's what's at stake here, is that there is no connection over the years that this has been done. It's well over 20 years of looking at high passing scores and then your performance as a teacher
mm-hmm.
and low passing scores and your performance as a teacher. And they're not predictive of one or the other.
They really pick on math on this
yeah,
thing,
a lot,
too,
a lot
don't they?
On math. Well, so there's something in there on the math basic skills test. Understand what this test is, too, right? If we think we're testing teachers as to whether or not they're going to be good teachers. This is a test of, quote, content knowledge that comes in the form of that basic multiple choice questions mm-hmm. over a 3-hour period where you sit there and try to figure out stuff you forgot.
Okay. Okay.
Right.
And that's always a tough thing.
And then it's scored, quote, on a normal curve for anybody out there. And so at some point, there has to be a group of people that fail. There has to be a large group of people in the middle that pass. And then there has to be a group that are stellar. And so it just doesn't fit the whole idea of going, I want a test to tell me whether or not someone's going to be a good teacher. Some have argued, and I'm pretty close to being one of them, I'm not sure we have a written exam that will ever predict great teaching.
No, I don't think so either.
Okay.
It even says in here that the correlation is just not there.
It's not there. So we already know using traditional numbers and research that it's not there. So if it's not there, then why have it? Well, I'll tell you why. Because in Wisconsin, where we are, we have them too. Just like all the other states, they cost money.
Oh, there it is.
They cost money. Is. And so, mm-hmm. But even more ridiculous, though, and this was in the article and you and I talked about this, is that the solution to those that don't pass
is hiring substitutes that don't even have to take it.
Right.
That's amazing.
There
answer.
You go. Okay.
I love it.
And of course, this would only come from politicians
right?
who would say, we're going to put a mandatory test for you to practice teaching. And if you don't pass it, we're going to allow others to teach for you who've never taken the test ever. And people look at that and go, that's ridiculous. No, we call it emergency licensing. In fact, we have it here in Wisconsin. If a school doesn't have a special education teacher, guess what we do? We now say, Bonnie, you're emergency certified.
Bam, just like that.
And I call school district and go, did you know that I have 7 to 10 students who have graduated but didn't pass one of these stupid exams, who are special education trained, who can't get into your classroom, but yet you're hiring an emergency certified person? Okay.
Makes sense.
Insanity.
From the JournalTimes.com, an editorial. Breaking out voucher dollars on tax bills is not the solution.
Well, then what's the solution, Bonnie?
Well, not this, obviously.
Okay, so let's education for those listening. You pay a tax bill if you own property, say, in a community.
Correct.
Okay,
yes.
So I have a house in a community. Mm-hmm. I get a property tax bill twice a year.
Yes.
And it is for a blank amount of dollars.
And they don't say what it is.
It doesn't say what it's for. And if I don't pay it, I'm in trouble.
Right.
And I go to the penalty box and I feel bad and all that. No, okay, right?
Yep.
So I pay my blank amount of money and it goes and then I'm happy. Okay. Well, in Racine, Wisconsin, they've said they're going to break it apart and kind of itemize it.
But just for?
Just for public schools.
Right.
So of the amount of money that I pay on my tax bill that goes to schools, they want to point out that so much of it goes to the local public schools and so much of it goes to the state voucher system here. So essentially,
So
what's the example? 91.3
million 91.3 went to schools.
Right, goes to schools, right?
72.64 million went to Racine Unified.
Mm-hmm. And 18.64 million went to the voucher schools.
Right.
Okay. Now, the journal opinion editorial piece says this is stupid because this is misleading because it doesn't tell the true story, which is people aren't going to get a tax reduction by this.
Right. You can't just say, I'm not going to pay this.
Right.
Part of the tax.
And it was never about that, though. It was about to say, Tim, of that amount of money you pay, did you know that here's how much of it is not going to your kid's school? And, oh, really? Well, why not? Well, because state law requires that a portion of everybody's taxes go to fund the state voucher system. Okay. So the author of this editorial is like, look, this is crazy because there's no tax break here. Duh. There was never about a tax break.
You're never going to get one.
You're not going to. Right. We know this. Death and taxes. It's not about a tax break. It was to be political. And he's offended by being political. But it is political to try to get people to understand that a portion of their money is not going to their local schools. Do they know about it? And if they did, what would they have to say about it? That's now up for, quote, state law. And according to the Journal Times, this is a bad idea. Tony Evers thinks it's a great idea. Bonnie says...
It's all confusing to me.
Yeah.
Time for Tim to rant. This is Someone Has to Say
More money, more money, more money. That's what we keep hearing. Our public schools need more money. Well, I don't know. If we have a systemically sick system of public education that generationally ranks, sorts, and disregards racial minorities, poor people, English language learners, special needs kids, and simultaneously demoralizes the teachers and staff in a public school, why would more money do anything but accelerate the demise of our kids, teachers, and communities? More money's for the continuation of an accountability system that was built to sort kids into an economy that only values them as disposable capital? No, I want to hear about more money to dismantle this ruinous culture. I want more money for real special education, ELL, and bilingual teachers, and for scrapping the faux license system that grants professional teaching responsibilities to respiratory systems that occupy the space in classrooms left by the fleeing professionals. Professionals who refuse to participate in a system that demands their obedience in the name of compliance, alignment, and curricular fidelity. I want more money for playgrounds, field trips, and art projects. I want more money for the dedicated individuals seeking a license through entities that value research and have a social justice mission with quality faculty that model teaching and learning as a compassionate exercise in liberating the mind. I want more money for a public system of education that dares to build a democratic community committed to critical thinking that disrupts our standardized and sanitized colonial education system. More money? Maybe.
We are Busting Pencils!
He is one of the three main editors of the incredibly popular Teaching for Black Lives. He's now one of the new editors for Rethinking Ethnic Studies. He's a former public high school teacher. He's an editor for the teaching magazine Rethinking Schools, and he is an educational studies professor at the University of Washington, Bothell. Welcome to Busted Pencils, Wayne Ah.
Hey, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
No problem, Wayne. So, I mean, that's the short bio. I asked you, I said, like, send me a bio. You're like, here's my long one, here's my short one. And I'm like, yeah, I'm going to make the short one even shorter. So there's all this stuff. It's like, it's crazy, though. You're doing all this stuff around ethnic studies, rethinking, you know, with Rethinking Schools. All of your work is just admirable around the social justice theme. Before we get into really talking about the issue, the new book, Rethinking Ethnic Studies, I mean, where does this passion come from for you?
You know, I mean, for me, it's just who I am. And I think for me, like, it's like, how do we make our way in the world and sort of live with ourselves? And, in my case, I feel like it's a commitment that I have as someone who's privileged enough to have a PhD and to be in a position of a professor, and also having been a public school teacher. It's just what drives me. You know, I can't. You know, there's no other reason for me to sort of be in existence in that sense, right? Like, we just have to fix these things, and it's what drove me to become a teacher to begin with.
Well, right there, being driven to become a public school teacher, and I think that's the other part is that you, some of my favorite higher ed people, you know, are the ones that still hold on to that initial passion of being a public school teacher to make a difference, and just carrying that through to the next level, whether it's becoming an administrator, whether it's becoming a higher ed professor, whether it's becoming, God forbid, a dean. The idea that we try to hold on to that seems, you know, something that I want to continue to encourage. And with Busted Pencils, you know, we kind of founded it on this idea, kind of a punk rock attitude, saying, you know, we're not going to take this crap, and we're going to use teaching and learning in the public school system to be what it's for, which is to create justice and equity.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's just that every turn, everywhere I've been, every kind of position, and I'm a dean now as well, so I really get what you're saying about the administrative piece. And really, it's just, to me, it's like, how are we going to create the conditions, you know, to really just help our students just become sharp and radical and active and really become the leaders for changing the world, you know?
Absolutely. And so, hence the new book. I mean, you're just coming off of Teaching for Black Lives, which is incredible. I had Jesse on the show. In fact, Jesse's coming to the Madison area here pretty soon to do a talk about this. But you're right back into it with Rethinking Schools, with Rethinking Ethnic Studies. You know, we're going to go into the book a little bit, but I mean, just from a framing, you and the editors, I mean, what's the motivation behind this book?
Yeah, well, so in addition to myself, the other editors include Toteca Coatin, Miguel Zavala, and Christine Sleeter. And really, this project actually started a full, I think, over 3 years ago at this point,
okay,
where both Toteca and Miguel separately had reached out to Rethinking the Schools and saying, hey, there's all this work going on. We should be thinking about a book. And so the four of us have been really, really working hard, you know, sort of trying to pull this collection together. And I think it needs to be understood in this broader context of really what's amounting to, in many ways, to be a national movement for there to be K-12 ethnic studies, right? Whereas historically, it came out of the universities and then the formation of ethnic studies departments, you know, particularly San Francisco State and UC Berkeley were where it was really where it started. And now there's ethnic studies as a field, but it's really only sort of caught hold in K-12 education, you know, in the last, you know, less than 10 years even. But now there's a thing happening all over the country, cities up and down the West Coast, Texas, and of course everyone knows about the famous case in Tucson, Arizona, where
right,
it got banned by the white supremacist legislators, and on the East Coast too, from Boston and Providence, and then also Chicago, and obviously New York. I mean, like, there's a thing happening here, and so all this sort of sets the context for the fact that we need to have a book that's, you know, folks who are doing this work and who are activists and who are classroom teachers, who are teaching this stuff and trying to work it out in the context of schools. And so we just sort of got together and reached out to as many folks as we could and pulled this massive volume together, really.
It's huge. I mean, the authors, the titles, the just every part of it just is amazing. I'm glad you said 3 years and not 3 months, because I'm looking at the size of this and going, this had to have taken a long time. But, you know, when you talk about ethnic studies too, I think sometimes people really relegate, still put that in like that's the realm of higher education, and
yeah,
and the connection to K-12, maybe the idea of, you know, studying minorities, the potential of even multicultural education, I think might still ring true to certain people. But, you know, there is, in fact, part one, you talk about framing ethnic studies. And so maybe let's start with, you know, first of all, what is part one? But then by asking the question, you know, what is ethnic studies?
Yeah, so, yeah, the first section really has sort of broader essays and where people are sort of thinking through and talking about, like, for instance, how do we distinguish between multicultural education and ethnic studies? How do we think about ethnic studies in terms of pedagogy? How do we think about it relative to, like, sort of the act of liberation, developing critical consciousness with students, right? And so it's these really big picture things. And so when we think about ethnic studies, you know, there's a lot of confusion around, like, is it the same as culturally relevant pedagogy or mm-hmm. multicultural education? And all these things are related, right? So we want to be clear. It's not that they're all distinct from each other. And you might be able to argue that, you know, ethnic studies could be put within a broader discussion of multicultural education, right? But there's a few things that I think distinguish ethnic studies from a lot of the other work. One is it's actually within the sort of lineage of multicultural education, ethnic studies really comes from a particularly sort of what I would argue is a radical space, right?
Mm-hmm.
It begins with the presumption of schools maintaining essentially white supremacy, right, and Eurocentrism and racism, and then so ethnic studies becomes this piece that says, hey, our job is to explicitly fight back against that kind of power structure, to push back against white supremacy, to push it back against colonization, to push back against racism. And so that automatically gives it this sort of, like, this like big picture sort of structural, like we're going to analyze institutionalized racism and how it functions in schools, and we're going to look at the Eurocentrism of history, and we're going to make corrections for that, right? We're going to understand that these systems operate, to dispossess people and land and culture, and so it takes this sort of this sort of really strong sort of activist bent that way too,
it's edgy, right? I mean, I'm a social studies guy, I'm a social studies scholar. I mean, James Banks love multicultural education.
And
you say absolutely, but it's the edge on ethnic studies and the intentional edge that I think and I'm glad the way you said that there. And so part one, we're going to get a look at that kind of this contrast, this broader study of quote understanding race, ethnicity, gender, and all these other things. But ethnic studies really comes at this from an edgy point that says, and we're going to have and make some change, which takes you to part two.
Yeah.
And, we love our big words. And I'm going to go with indigeneity and roots.
Yep.
Okay. So what's happening in indigeneity and roots?
Yeah, in section two on indigeneity and roots, really is to kind of look at this idea. We kind of do two things here. One, we want to look at the role of colonization and the status of indigenous nations relative to that colonization, and then also to understand that there is a kind of indigenousness to everybody. Right, and I think it's one of the things, and there's a real tension with the ethnic studies community, don't get me wrong, but like, for instance, I think it's important that we recognize that white folks are actually indigenous to some areas, right? Like, and we need to recognize that they came here under certain circumstances, and they play a particular role in sort of maintaining settler colonialism and being on this land and in this space, right? And there's something about the construction of the United States that works to hide all that. And so the role of ethnic studies would be to unearth that, right? And so, but even more importantly to the book then is to kind of look at, okay, what does it mean to just like understand ourselves? What's the kind of teaching we do to help students understand their own roots, where they come from, how do students make sense of that? And really the first section of the book tries to take that up.
Well, that indigenous part, right, that's at the core of this is to say, when we look at, I guess, everybody in America, there's some form of indigenousness to we're all. But I think the to really point out, though, that you're talking about here, I mean, what was the, when we hear it in Wisconsin here, we see a nice push to really recognize, and in fact, it's in state law that, to talk about the indigenous people of Wisconsin as part of the school curriculum. Now, it's not nearly as edgy as I think we would like to have in ethnic studies, but understanding that is a totally different experience of indigenousness than to say we all have some form of indigeneity.
Yes, and to be clear, like we could, the intent here is not to sort of do something similar to like, oh, we're all immigrants thing, right?
No, right.
Erase Native folks and the specific experiences, that those folks have experienced their histories, right? So we're not trying to erase that at all, that's why we're trying to sort of split it both ways. Like we need to recognize, sort of colonization and survival of native communities and what that is for what it is, but then also understand that there are roots to folks, right? No matter where and what we come from, and so we tend, for us as editors, we tend to believe that it's the denial of these roots that's part of the function of white supremacy in the United States, frankly. And so we want folks to be able to push against that white supremacy and that racism and sort of begin to sort of understand themselves more historically, right? And part of that then is recognition of the roots and sort of exploring that.
Well, we are talking to Wayne Ah. He is one of the new editors he's not a new editor, but he's one of the editors of the new book, Rethinking Ethnic Studies. We got through parts one and part two. We're moving into part three, colonization and dehumanization. So, Wayne, when we get into part three of the book, what's happening?
Yeah, so in part three of the book, we're really looking at really concrete sort of like lessons and role plays and classroom experiences about how teachers have taught and can teach the role of colonization, you know, in the history of what we now know as the United States. And a real central piece of that is understanding the ways that the colonizers used dehumanization as a central tool to sort of justify their you know, the heinous and sort of terrible acts that they did.
See, and that's like an incredibly radical reframing of colony and colonization, especially when you start talking to maybe people like me in their 50s, a little bit older, who, when we studied about the 13 original colonies and colonization, we were celebrating.
Right, and it's one of the things that sort of, I think, makes ethnic studies different from sort of the broad base of multicultural education, right? Because, you know, there's some models of multicultural education, like, okay, we're going to just celebrate difference, or we're going to highlight multiple perspectives, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then, but for us, when we take, like, especially with, like, this section three, it sort of highlights how in ethnic studies, we need to understand that there are processes at play, right? And colonization is a process. And so it's not, so at the establishment of the original colonies, you know, it's happening on the backs and the lands of Native people, right? And it's part of this broader sort of longer project of taking Native land and challenging Native sovereignty, right? And so within ethnic studies, we really want to have teaching that highlights that process and from a critical perspective, so that it's, you know, so that's less of sort of the celebration of difference and more about, hey, there's a gritty reality here of what happened to Native peoples on this continent.
Yeah, and as you point, you know, it's a dehumanizing process, which,
yep,
you know, which is the intent of, quote, colonialism, is to lift up the colonizers, delegitimize those who are not, dehumanize those who don't accept, and then, as you said, push forward this whole idea of colonization and white supremacy. So, you know, tough. It's going to be an interesting chapter, I think, where people are going to really have a sense of going, wow, this is what separates ethnic studies from, quote, as you said, multicultural education, because now we're getting into the realities, right?
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, in section four on hegemony,
I was going to say, which leads us to hegemony,
work,
right?
You know?
Hey, let's do it quick, though. The hegemony is one of those words. It's like pedagogy, right? It's like, well, what do you mean by that? So hegemony and normalization. So
let's do a quick
vocabulary. Hegemony means...
Yeah, let's talk about hegemony and normalization. So that's the reason why we put normalization on
there.
Because really the whole idea behind hegemony is that, you know, here are these you know, these relationships, right? Here we have all these inequalities and these differences in power, and we're dealing with stuff, you know, things like, you know, institutionalized racism and colonization and white supremacy and these things that are ongoing. And so hegemony ends up being this word that sort of describes, like, how do we maintain that, right? How are those relationships being reinforced, in this case through curriculum or through textbooks or through other kinds of teaching? And so this section then starts to look at, okay, like, what are we being taught in our textbooks,
mm-hmm,
right? Or by media or, you know, other means of what we might consider the curriculum of life and experience, right? And then so the chapters in this section, in section four, really look at how teachers have worked with students to really, like, critically engage and challenge those dominant narratives that they've been getting, those hegemonic narratives that have been used to sort of justify, you know, all these inequalities and all the racism, colonization and stuff that folks have been experiencing.
Yeah, and then, you know, we start to make the shift here in parts five and part six, but part five, regeneration and transformation.
Yeah.
So give us, you know, what's happening?
Yeah, and so this other piece, right, like one of the things that one of the things that people have, you know, often critique ethnic studies and more sort of radical teaching and learning is that, hey, it's all just critical,
it's,
right?
All you're doing is complaining. Down. You're just making everybody angry. You're just upsetting white people. And,
yeah,
you know.
And really you're just taking everything apart. You know, you're not building anything. And that's one of the things I think is really important about ethnic studies is there's a whole side of it that's also about healing. Right, like if we're dealing with a system that has caused trauma for peoples of color, that's connected to colonization, then we also need to be about thinking about, like, how do we think about teaching and learning in a way that's also about healing from this trauma, right? And so this section around regeneration and transformation really starts to look at, you know, one of the pieces is around cultivating self-love, right? Other pieces are about, for instance, looking at what sources of knowledge and strength and cultural wealth do students bring with them into the classroom, right? So getting away from a purely sort of deconstruction and criticizing of everything, and trying to move to a point where we're trying to say, okay, how can we like create classroom spaces that are that are healing for students, you know, that they can use to rebuild their identities and be stronger and move out into the world.
Yeah, it's that, you know, critical for what? And you're answering the what here. And it's not a simple answer, but this, you know, it's like this is not just to be critical, it's to build a critical consciousness, to build then from that consciousness, hopefully a new consciousness. And then part six, organizing for and really important sustaining ethnic studies, because as you pointed out early on, I mean, this is not without its controversy. In fact, going back to Arizona in 2011, the banning of ethnic studies. And today we still hear ramblings of that type of, you know, banning. It was in Arizona again, of course. It was coming out of Peter Green's Curm Education, where we're going to ban teachers' political talk, which, of course, would have then translated into, guess what? You can't teach ethnic studies. It's another way around this. And so, organizing for, how do we continue to organize for and support ethnic studies?
Yeah, and so this section for us was really like really important because, you know, we know where it's been sort of successful and we've been able to sort of move districts or states or individual schools and bringing ethnic studies, and other places want to do this, right? And so we're trying to create a space. In a way, this is a teaching section too, because it's a space for all of us to learn from each other, right? Mm-hmm. Even though we've been doing a lot of this work in Seattle, for instance, it helps me to understand what happened in Sacramento or in Providence, or like how did they get ethnic studies? And then it'll help someone who doesn't have ethnic studies at their school or their district to go, hey, here's the path they went, you know, in this city, and then they went this path in this other city. You know, which one do we think will work for us, or how can we adapt these strategies and make them useful? So I really saw this. We really saw this as a space where all these ethnic studies activists were able to sort of help teach each other collectively around how to bring ethnic studies into context, and so we can just learn from each other and do it better and keep improving it. And it's also a reminder. It's the sustaining part's important here too, because it's also a reminder that it always comes out of a struggle, right? And in order to keep it, we're gonna have to keep fighting in order to sustain it, in order to keep it alive. Even though once we've won it, doesn't mean that we've won. You know, there's several of these districts I know in Portland, for instance. You know, they got it passed in the district, and the students were really involved, and the community activists were really involved, and the teacher activists were really involved. But then the district started to co-opt it, right? And then suddenly it's like becoming this district thing, and then the student voice and the teacher activist voice and stuff had started to disappear, and it was becoming this whole other thing, right? It wasn't the ethnic studies that they fought for, and so now they had to wage another round of struggle to try and turn it into what they had protested for to begin with, right?
Right.
And so it's going to be a fight, and we have to maintain it.
Well, it's you know, and it probably comes down to this silly notion of, well, we need to teach both sides, Wayne. right. And we have this conversation. It's like, well, I don't know both sides of the Holocaust. Is there another side to the Holocaust? right. But people seem to think that, you know, we got to tell both sides of the story. We see it here in D.C. now with the Catholic school in Kentucky and Nathan Phillips, the Native American elder, and everybody screaming, you know, there's two sides to this story. And it's like,
the white supremacist side,
right.
The side for justice. So
right.
Which one are you trying? Like,
so which
you,
one are you doing? Yeah. Right. So Wayne, it's rethinking ethnic studies, and specifically though, you work with Rethinking Schools on this book.
Yeah, absolutely. And so this book will be available. It's literally at the printer, and should be available by mid-February.
Okay.
And so you can get it at www.rethinkingschools.org, along with many other incredible books, including Teaching for Black Lives, And so, yeah, I would encourage everyone, if you want to check out the book, you can see the beautiful cover we got for it, and get a chance to look at the table of contents, and easiest place to order it.
Yeah, so that's rethinkingschools.org/, and actually I got a little bit more for that, RES.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah, so I'm guessing the RES is Rethinking Ethnic Studies.
Absolutely.
So online, Rethinking Ethnic Studies, go to rethinkingschools.org. You can find it there. And hey, Wayne, and tell this to the other editors, but you guys truly busted some pencils.
Thanks, Tim. Appreciate it.
Hey, this is Tim from Rise Against here on Busted Pencils Radio.
What an awesome treat today. Peter from Hawaii, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you.
Now, check it out. So, Peter, we met through my son. You're a freshman now here in the what do they call it, the upper 48, or it's not even the or the lower 48, or
the continental U.S.
Continental U.S.
We'll call it. Yeah.
You're Peter from Hawaii.
Right. Yeah.
So the other, when you're in Alaska, it's the lower 48. Mm. So in Hawaii, it's the continental.
Yes.
Okay. Cool. So now we got that straight. So Busted Pencils listeners in the continental. Hey, we have people in Hawaii too, because you can live stream this everywhere.
For sure.
But so first year in the continental, grew up. Where at in Hawaii?
Eva Beach, Hawaii, so like the island of Oahu. It'd be more like Waikiki, Honolulu, what people would recognize easier.
Okay, and so the question, you're a real Hawaiian?
Yes.
As opposed, well, right, depends on what how do you define that, right?
Yeah, it depends on how you would define like a real Hawaiian, and like I could totally go on a total tangent on this, but I'll just give you a little dip in it. But a real Hawaiian is just someone that appreciates the land for what it is and doesn't want to destroy it for their own wealth. It's someone that wants to share it and really just preserve the land. That's, to me, a real Hawaiian.
So if you have that attitude, it's okay to come in maybe then as a white person?
Yeah, if you have that attitude, is like, hey, you know, I respect your culture, I respect your land, and this is why I'm here. I'm not here to build these giant hotels or take your homes away from you. No, I want to help you.
But that isn't one of the issues, though, that you're talking about when, as a native Hawaiian, and if we put that in there, you do, though, have cultural roots within the native Hawaiian history? Ancestral roots? Too.
What do you mean?
Family members that when we say, you know, native Hawaiian, yeah, you know, quote, whatever a real Hawaiian is. But I mean, just so that the listener understands, I mean, you have family roots that go back.
Oh, yeah,
for sure. Generations.
Yeah, yeah. Like, it's a little diluted. Like, I'm a little bit mixed with other things, but I definitely do have native Hawaiian family back home. Yeah.
Okay. Right. And you went to school there?
Yes, of course.
In an American public school?
Yeah.
Because Hawaii is America.
Yes, it is. It is the 50th state.
It's the 50th.
Just in case you didn't know.
Man, thank you. I'm glad that somebody could verify that. There's a lot of people out there that still aren't sure, you know. But so American public schools, and Peter, what I wanted to talk to you about, though, when you and I met for the first time a couple weeks ago, I presented you with that I had been in Hawaii for a conference talking to some researchers who work in Hawaii, and particularly looking at the idea of what is taught in the public schools, and this idea that they were really trying to help schools and community activists in the Hawaiian public schools reestablish a more culturally relevant curriculum. And you kind of pointed at me, but talked to me very specifically about, oh, like I knew when they were pushing in the textbooks stuff that was not Hawaiian.
Right.
So what's not Hawaiian about an American textbook?
Yeah, for sure. Like the one way that they're going to, you know, I guess colonize us is first attack our education. You know, you force the younger generations to learn a certain way, and you basically take things out. You don't necessarily need to lie to them, but you can see where there are plot holes in the story that you might be reading about. You know, for instance, like the annex of Hawaii, like people think that we are legally annexed, but as a matter of fact, we were illegally annexed, where we have Hawaiians that have signed petitions that were completely disregarded in the whenever this all happened, and Hawaii was basically just illegally annexed. And
that's not in your book.
That's not in the textbooks. That's not what they're saying. What they give us a simple story where our Queen Liliuokalani was locked in her own palace and was forced to sign the annex. But no, that's not what happened.
Right. So it's just this whole idea, because we talk about this a lot in the American public schools, whether it's from particularly a Black Lives Matter perspective, which really, you know, this idea of culture and people's culture and kind of looking at the American curriculum as kind of a way of neutralizing any culture, and very specifically, but you use that word, and this is the word I want to, you know, spend some time on, colonial. And there really is, first of all, Hawaii was, as you, and did I say it the right way that
yep.
time? Okay.
It's fine.
Was a colony.
Mm-hmm.
We forget about that, right? And so the idea, I'm sure everybody learned in their American textbook about the colonists. Of course, we didn't talk about the Hawaiian colonists.
Right.
But Hawaii was a colony. But the what happens when you colonize something, and let's try to maybe put this in as objective of terms, you know, you occupy, you take over, you create a place, a settlement, because that typically is also how we teach colonists who create settlements, who then create cities. The fact is, though, is that the story that we typically don't tell is, who was there first?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Who was there? Yeah.
Right.
Literally, who was there first?
So whether it's the 13 original colonies here on the eastern side mm-hmm. of the continental states, as you would say,
yep.
The assumption of colonization is always presented as kind of this neutral place where people settled and created civilization. And if there are local inhabitants mentioned, you talked about this, is the portrayal of the local inhabitants is extremely inaccurate.
Right.
So give me an example.
So like you can like easily manipulate how, especially with history, how things were, even especially if like you weren't there, you know, and I feel like that happens a lot. So maybe one would be Captain Cook, when he first came to the islands of Hawaii, you know, he called them the Sandwich Islands. People might be like familiar with that story, but he was like one of the first people to discover the islands. And, you know, he was portrayed as a god, and in a sense, but he really wasn't, you know, he was just some white guy who came down and.
but I mean, more about, you know, the colonization aspect mm-hmm. of particularly Native peoples is too, then put it back into the book is the fact is that colonization is the result of goodness, because what you were doing as a Native.
Like goodness how? Like what?
Well,
what
I'm just saying, in the book of the presentation, right, is that, let's go to the Eastern again. These are savages.
Right, okay.
And so colonization is a benefit,
mm-hmm.
even to the local inhabitants.
No, like.
Well, you're like, no,
yeah, like,
no.
I have some, yeah.
But in the book that you were presented,
this is good for them.
That's what I'm saying. It's like, how is that being a Native Hawaiian mm-hmm. and reading that colonization is good for you?
Right.
That's where I'm coming at.
Okay. Yeah, like, it's crazy. Like, what you said, like, people will look and it's like, yeah, we colonized them because it was good for them. But in actuality, it's good for the people colonizing them. If you're, like, looking at it, it's like, who owns all the homes back home, back in Hawaii? Who owns the hotels? Who owns the land? It's not the Hawaiians, I'll tell you that much. It's not.
It's the colonists.
It is. It really is. So who's really benefiting from it?
Right.
Not the Hawaiians.
So then you take your education system, and along with this, and we say it's been done in any type of hostile takeover of anything. The idea of colonizing the curriculum then mm-hmm. is then to say, okay, we've now colonized the land. Now we need to colonize the mind.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. So they'll take out our culture first off. Like for a short period of time, dancing hula and chanting and praying in Hawaiian was illegal. It was basically banned. And for the Hawaiians, that was a big deal because it's like, well, what are we supposed to do now? Practice this Christian, this Judaism, this, you know, these different religions that we don't want to, mm-hmm. but you're making us, you know?
Right.
And implementing all of these things into also our education, like you mentioned, basically just shapes our mind the way they want us to. They want us to think that what they did for us was good and that they got us out of, like, what, savagery? But if you do research now, Hawaii was very self-sustainable before any interactions with the outside world. And now we can't go 2 weeks without imports, like 2 weeks and we're out of, you know, our supply. And Hawaii was like one of the main places to get like natural resources. Like, you know, we had sugarcane, pineapple, and, you know, we relied solely on the land. But now we rely so much on these imports and these colonizations. And it's like, what happened to...
Well, yeah, so you're pointing out the negatives. So what about this aspect then of these, you know, colleagues of mine that I met in Hawaii that are saying, no, we need a restorative curriculum at a minimum mm-hmm. in the public schools in Hawaii?
Yeah, like, don't get me wrong. There's nothing wrong with, like, learning this standard curriculum to an extent where it's like, you know, yeah, everybody needs their math, their English, and history and whatnot. Well, history
becomes,
to,
yeah, right?
But when the history comes, like, a part of it, it's definitely they should intertwine like the truth and like Hawaiian history as well. And from that, you can learn a lot from like Hawaiian culture and the language. And it's like it's just so much different.
Well, I always think about the knowledge lost when you colonize somebody's mind with curriculum, mm-hmm. right? And one of the things you were talking about particularly, you know, was a very self-sustaining Hawaii. And the idea that it's not now, and it's like, well, you know, where's that knowledge of self-sustaining? Yeah. And in fact, that benefits society. And so people, you know, typically you get this liberal progressive propaganda crap you're trying to, you know. No, it's like there's wonderful knowledge mm-hmm. that we've almost lost.
Yeah.
In fact, I think one of the researchers I was working with was really talking about a big push to reclaim and save the native language, because it's endangered.
Exactly. Yeah, it is. Like, especially with my generation, I don't know too much Hawaiian myself. Like, I wouldn't be able to speak fluently, but I know like terms here and there, which is a lot better than what is actually being taught now. And the language is so beautiful. And like you said, like knowledge being lost, it's because of like the generations just down the line. It's like, first off, there's no with like all the like grocery stores and stuff, like less farms, less farmland, and just less land to rely on, there's no reason for that knowledge. There's no like push to have it. And I feel like that might be a reason to why.
There's a little bit of resistance. Yeah. In fact, now you start seeing the not benefit, but the motive of colonizing mm-hmm. the curriculum is to say, look, in one way,
it's like you don't need it anymore.
Yeah. And you know, we talk about this. It's like it keeps you trapped in the colonial frame. And so, you know, I'm interested. I appreciate the time you're taking here to talk about this, because we're spending more time in Busted Pencils working with this idea. And it's, the bigger thing is it's culturally sensitive pedagogy, or the idea that we're going to teach around the culture, not teach the culture out.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the beneficiaries, of course, are people who've lost their culture. But the other beneficiaries are those of us who never got to experience the culture to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, exactly. Like, I feel like there is definitely like knowledge hungry people out there, and that would definitely appreciate learning about not necessarily just the Hawaiian culture, but a lot of other cultures that may have been, you know, weeded out from this colonial push that's been happening recently. So like for me personally, I know when I first started learning about like the Hawaiian things, just even small things like in school, like when we had to learn about Hawaiian history, it intrigued me so much. I loved learning about the religion, even though not necessarily I might believe in it, but it's just definitely interesting to learn like why we did things the way we did back in the day. And it's just so much more beautiful than being forced to learn something, to take a test, and then never use it ever again, while like this Hawaiian history that I have in my heart will never be taken away from me.
Man, on that one, Peter from Hawaii, thanks for busting pencils.
Yeah, thanks, Tim.
Time now for our weekly salute to legendary historian and activist Howard Zinn.
This is your moment of zen.
I'm concerned that students not become passive acceptors of the official doctrine that's handed down to them from the White House, the media, textbooks, teachers, and preachers.
My thanks to Wayne Awe and Rethinking Schools and Peter from Hawaii. I'm Dr. Tim Slecker. Thanks for busting pencils.
Log on to BustedPencils.com for the latest trending news, blogs, past shows, and more. Subscribe to our podcast in iTunes and Google Play. And get daily updates by following us on Facebook and Twitter at Busted Pencils. This is Fully Leaded Education Talk. Busted Pencils Radio.